Finally, I'm glad to introduce today's final presentation, about which I'm very excited, by Nida Gauss and Malak Helmi, who together work under the title Emotional Architecture on the question of collaboration and what remains of the knowledge and shared experiences after they break up. I guess a kind of micro reflection on the larger question that already started to be addressed by Erhard Schüttpelz earlier on the question of shared experiences and literacy. A choreography for A Burning House, Nida Gauss and Malak Helmi.
I see you
and begin to mirror you.
The state
sees us and begins to mirror us. It's almost 11 p.m. and a girl arrives for a drink. She steps out the elevator, walks past the bar and into open air. She looks around and then joins two guys sitting together at a table. She had expected only one of them, but then again, they both have exactly the same name. At some point, three turns into two once more. He takes his cue to step off stage, calls it a night, exits the frame. As she says, almost inadvertently, to the one who remains, "Won't you leave this city for a moment?" Something she could only do, for she had insufficient history and therefore little capacity to comprehend the implications of what tomorrow might bring. We started by calling it the summer of two fires and a landslide. The upper house of the parliament burned down, and the main stage of the National Theatre went alight. On the outskirts, a rock face gave way to an avalanche of big boulders that buried people under their own homes. As the rescue operations closed, there was news of a passenger train that had burst into flames. It was on an outbound route, but for some reason, our memory is of it coming into the city ablaze. Why do we recall a spectacle that never happened, one which we had never seen? How does one tell an impossible story? I've asked myself for as long as I've remembered it by heart, but every time I sit down to it, meaning resists being written. Saying it out loud in confidence, I've learned is doable. A late night conversation between no more than two people, and they must be missed the crowd. Disguised in chatter, the story stood up on the table and danced itself in the dark. Took years before it even occurred to me to try it out that way.
Our talk today draws on work from and around our first publication. We started by calling it The Summer of Two Fires and a Landslide, of our project Emotional Architecture. And it takes its cue in part from Claire Davies' proposal for a dance choreography to be performed at the Royal Opera House, in which a woman, coming to grips with the end of a relationship, burns like a building. The publication was put together in 2013. It was concerned with notions of spontaneous combustion and material refusal in relation to the incineration of significant buildings in Cairo at various points in its history, particularly responding to a five-week period in August and September of 2008. It was a time during which we felt that animate and inanimate forms in the city began to shed and exchange their properties, performing the behavior of the other and possessing action and color at will. The particular historical context of this combustion was marked by the absence of a certain possibility of speech and also a certain possibility of protest. The People's Assembly Archive in the Shura Council or the Upper House of Parliament, which could be thought of as the corridor of political decision-making, and the National Theatre, or the site of spectacle, arguably one of the more prominent stages of cultural production in the region, both burnt down just weeks from each other. It was a time, which we'll talk about more later in this talk, of total contagion, seemingly orchestrated yet attributable to none. It was as if the mere anarchy of witnessing could cause an accidental, uncoordinated collective event.
Just to explain a bit more, the summer of 2008 came in the wake of an event that took place and is now colloquially referred to as April 6th, when a general strike, largely by Egyptian workers in the state-run textile industry in response to low wages and rising food costs. The protests took place in factories that were outside of Cairo in Mahalla, At the same time, in downtown Cairo, a protest organized by the left intelligentsia did not take place, as many of the main protagonists in this strike had already been arrested in the days running up to it. A demonstration was denied, and the streets were almost absolutely empty, a sight unseen in Cairo, save for policemen in plain clothes and a seasonal sandstorm that cast a haze across the day.
So, at a time when certain things that were being suppressed and could not actually be said or even imagined, other things stepped in to act from that space of speech, or perhaps in place of that speech, and in turn decided to protest. It was as if in response to that tension, that suffocation even, the airtight pressure built up by the forced denial of that speech and protest, that these prime state buildings could not but combust. They set themselves alight, and it was almost as if the matter of the state, official buildings but also archives, decided to commit a kind of suicide.
In the event of the upper house of parliament burning, people gathered in the streets to watch a spectacle of state burning. Could this act of watching the heat of these bodies gathered in the streets as they had done so before and would do so again have initiated a possibility, an opening up of an imagination which was not available before? Say to imagine the end of a regime, the one that one was already watching, that then would slowly enter consciousness and speech and become a possibility. It was a fantastic fire. The building was old and largely made of wood. Fire engines from the station 5 minutes away took hours to arrive. A single helicopter could be seen scooping water from the Nile. People gathered there in the streets, not only not believing their eyes, but looking through the screens of phone cameras as if in confirmation.
If we were to follow this line of thinking, a flip occurs, wherein the allowance to begin to imagine the end of a regime is initiated by matter, a reversal even in so far as the logic of how things burn. In the upper house of the parliament, the fire started on the third floor, and then the building, the fire started to burn downwards, against the law, to the ground. Some of what we felt at that time and are doing and thinking through this event is in order to perhaps ask questions to history, questions such as, what did that burning building know? What might it have been saying? What world was it opening itself up to? Because it did feel at that time that the act of self-immolation was an act of protest. In that sense, we have tried and are still trying to understand the language of fire, what was being said in that moment when certain things consumed themselves and ate themselves up.
The burning of these buildings can be thought of in relation to the notion of an electrical short circuit, which, at least in the case of 2008, was what the fires were attributed to. Insofar as the state's narrative, nothing much else was declared. An electrical short circuit, as per its definition, often results from the unintended contact of components and the consequent accidental diversion of a current. We can think about the notion of the short circuit in relation to three possible cinematic tropes. In popular cinema, short circuits are gateways to other dimensions, where by way of freak incidents, such as in Honey, I Blew Up the Kids or Back to the Future, we arrive at an opening to other possible worlds that are governed by different, often uncanny set of codes and rules. So an opening up to a world where something in this world may be unbelievable and unimaginable, but in that world is entirely possible. In the avant-garde cinema of 1920s, Eisenstein offers a theory of a montage of attractions in which he proposes that new meaning is generated in art through conflict and tension. He develops a method of producing images by placing singular details of two independent ideograms or semiotic units next to one another, letting them explode into something new. This collision into new meaning is made possible by an interval, a cut between one world and another. This dynamic confrontation is enabled by forces of attraction, compelled to attain a balance of contradiction, a process by which two elements make a third new compound and achieve chemical equilibrium in the process. In terms of the materiality of celluloid, which is highly inflammable in its composition, the possibility of combustion is already inherent in the object of cinema. So we can think not only about the image of something burning, but also about the burning of the image itself. On one hand, we have the act of seeing a fire captured in an image, and on the other, we watch the cinema itself burn, a fire started by a reel of film that was set alight. We will keep this concise, but just to point to the scenes of the burning cinema in Inglourious Basterds, but also to the 26th of January, 1952, a day called Black Friday, when all of downtown Cairo was burnt down, and 40 cinemas were set on fire.
So in thinking about this kind of collaboration between matter and meaning, we'll briefly introduce Emotional Architecture, a project we started sometime in 2012 in Cairo. It began as a series of conversations that were conceived as an exercise in addressing the social, intellectual, and psychic legacies of entering and leaving collaborations. We first began thinking about the idea of emotional architecture in relation to the notion of collaboration. A lot has been said and written about collaboration in the art context. These texts and talks are both reflexive in that they consider how collaborations operate within the art context, as well as expansive in that they extend to consider conditions of labor, of work in the world. A text that was influential for us was Florian Schneider's Notes on Collaborations, in which Schneider sets up a dichotomy, positioning the practice of collaboration in opposition to the more palpable notion of cooperation. The more provocative understanding of collaboration that he offers is of it as a brusque and ungenerous practice, what he calls the other side of a material labor. In collaboration, everyone may be working for their own self-interest. Everyone is in it for different reasons and therefore benefits from it in different ways. Collaboration, nonetheless, leads to all sorts of potentially precious outcomes. Part of that beauty of collaboration is that everybody's work points to someone else's, such that there is no clear authorship. Also in a collaboration, a person can benefit another by passing on knowledge that she herself does not possess.
We started to think about the fact that there's not much said about the emotional register of collaboration, of what forms, sustains, supports, and props up collaboration. What is its infrastructure or architecture? How does power operate within it? In thinking through a range of situations, from minor artist collectives and temporary social movements to grand historical narratives, we began by asking what happens to knowledge that was born in collaboration when collaborations break up, which often they do. So grand narratives in the sense of asking how does one break up with history, or with the canon, we might say. We talked together with friends about how certain dynamics of power become apparent like a ghost of an underlying governing structure, but only in moments of emotional involvement and heightened awareness in which a threshold has been breached. We wanted to articulate what it is that comes to be known in these encounters with one's own ideological or physiological limits, specifically in relation to collective contexts in which the soul is at work. We tried to contain these events in language, and for our second publication, No Fantasy Without Protest, we commissioned our collaborators, Mu'taz Atallah, Lina Atallah, and Philip Risk, to write as much as possible from the edges of their interdiscipline: journalism, activism, filmmaking, education, comedy, philosophy, anthropology, and art history. What we found instead was that meaning breaks down and that it grows harder to speak with conviction when one no longer inhabits those conditions and can no longer see the apparition. Our engagement with these concerns happened to have developed at a particular political disjunction, during which the ground of our analysis kept moving and the rules no longer applied. So what are the social, intellectual, and psychic legacies of entering and leaving collaborations? This is not so much a question of what one claims after collaboration, insofar as an ownership of ideas, but rather of how one survives them. And perhaps more importantly, looked at the other way, what is it that survives collaboration? What is it that remains as residue or as excess? What is it, the thing that surpasses the end of collaboration?
Keyword Searches for Habit is a video that was composed in 2009 in response to an invitation to an exhibition titled Invisible Presence in Cairo. It is structured around translating the Arabic word habit into English, producing the terms dust, aerosol, as in suspended liquids and gas that have an explosive quality, vanity, as in mirroring, and chaos, as in the condition caused by the inimitable loss of information. Habit is generally defined in Arabic also, as the moment when one sees individual particles of dust suspended in the air, particles that are rarely visible to the naked eye, that are seen only in a particular quality of light that has the capacity to draw these suspended particles into focus. It is also a term used in idioms, in Arabic, to express the moment when all meaning is lost, and at other times when everything goes up in flames. I took this image of the site of a forthcoming exhibition on the 20th of July at 10:02 to scope the ground for a production. The following shots were taken of this and this and this. In the fourth image was the shadow of a man in the right third of a room. He did not look at me and swept for 4 minutes in a square of 3 meters. The dust did not move. He swept silence. Sound billowed from around him, producing beige stillness in the air, broken by slithering pixels of habit around himself. While scanning the image's edges, I noticed the room carried calcified dunes in its corner pockets, dunes that this man could not seem to sweep away. Leaning gently seaward and leeward, a carved arch like that between the lower back and the tailbone, a curve like the cheek from the ads of that perfume. So then I got in there and bent my knees, lowered my thighs, leaned my weight, to get near enough for smelling distance, to see closely a hazed edge, out of focus, a crest, moving ever so slightly, going somewhere else, grain by grain. And as the dune moved, I trailed it as it tried to sneak itself away. The sweeping man said, "The building is ill. It's been sloughing. It's shedding its own skin." And then I left, and this is the last that I saw of the site and the exhibition that never took place. I took this image on the side of a window on the 30th of August at 12 noon to scope particles of dust in the lungs of a chamber that lead me into the city. The following shots I took were of this and this and this. In the 10th image was the face of a mannequin in the left third of the room that for 3 years shed 70 to 80,000 skin cells a day, crumbling outer layers to produce an unfocused edge, shedding flakes, diamond pixel tiles around herself. I took her to a doctor to inquire why a mannequin would be inducing its own destruction. He got up close to smelling distance, crouched his thighs, traced and tracked the fabric of her plastic limbs, and focused closely on her blurred edge. Prodded into the absent sections, chunks of her have moved away, he said, tile by tile. He said she was ill, looked at me suspicious and asked who started it. I said I didn't know which of us was the source of the shedding. He said one of us dropped a sequence from the verses of our skin, and as a mirror the other translated, another sequence lost, then was reflected back, an absent response, then transferred forth, an absence produced, and so on, a sequence, or lack thereof, mutated by empathetic exchange. He could not say what was absent and what was produced, what was cast and what was amassing, but he was getting ill by overwatching. The issue, he said, was this empathetic contagion, the potential of an epidemic, of collective enactment by overviewing. I took this video from the site of an unknown location on the night of the 30th of August at 11:02 to scope the possibility of personification, the possibility of reflexive symptoms, like the light from fireflies that spontaneously pulse in response to each call, until they all pulse in rhythm, like this, and this, and this. To make 100 volts of luciferase is 1 sheet of white light. The doctor used this to test my DNA, injected me with the glow of fireflies that would lodge themselves in holes in skin where mine or the mannequin's sequence had flaked off. The absence, he said, is transferable, fillable, illuminable. They tracked me with black light, but my pulses were silent. They tracked her with black light and saw the holes where things were missing. They watched them glow as luciferase seeped into skin cells that cast off as fluorescent dust. On the mornings of the month of September, I took the dust from the site of her body to scope the city for whirlwinds and found images of this and this and this. The doctor and I blew it into the air to trace pulses with pink markers under black lights. I began to see cars on a highway that would signal back and forth while approaching a predator or a lover. A little off at first, flickering, until it became one synced sheet beating, but as it reflected back and forth, it overproduced light, and the dark fell out of the sequence. There was no dark. All glowed like an unstoppable fire, with sparkling diamond-cut reflections, slithering glossy pixels underneath. But then the pulsing stopped, and it became one single tone, like one organismic sheet of brilliant white light. Then the doctor told me, "You know, fireflies no longer exist. They died long ago with the darkness. But we extracted their luciferase and we use it to trace a trail of images to produce each other and produce seizures."
Scientifically speaking, a mirror neuron is a neuron that fires both when an animal acts and when the animal observes the same action being performed by another. The neuron mirrors the behavior of the other as though the observer itself was acting, as an intimate muscle or atomic memory. It is by this process that we largely learn and develop motor actions. Mirror neurons are the neural basis of the human capacity for emotions such as empathy. It is in many ways that the body confuses the act of having seen something as the act of having done it, learning as a means of feeling for others. It's an act of literal embodiment through witnessing, of being both the other and the self at once.
It was during that event that we keep referring to that we came to be interested in the notion of empathetic exchange, or in the possibility of reflexive symptoms between different kinds of matter under duress. In conditions of extreme pressure, something shifted such that emotional communication between different kinds of formal and chemical compositions, say a human in a building, became possible. These agents were no longer separated by their different ontologies. The act of mutual witnessing enabled an autonomy to exist between these different bodies, a contagion of qualities and behaviors. And when we say that these things happen, we're not saying it as a poetic device. Perhaps through a particular lens, it would be called a kind of psychosis, such that it appears to be a symptom of schizophrenia or mania, when one can disassociate from oneself and associate with others or other beings. Taken to an extreme, one confuses or even refuses any separation between oneself and everything else. One reads and feels everything together at once, insists on the memory of an experience they may not have had. But perhaps it was not psychosis either, at least not exactly. Rather, we were at the brink of another paradigm in which we could sense the burning building in relation to a larger context of events and non-events. This also changed the terms of what was possible in language as well, such that we could say that the building was in protest.
About this. And there you go. Oh. Done.
Okay.
A woman is having a conversation on a phone. She is a painter, and her lover is a young woman named Dahlia, who is also her muse. She has just learned that Dahlia is engaged to be married. She pleads with her on the phone, then, finding no way through, hangs up and has a breakdown. This is the first paragraph of Claire Davies' text, Cairo Variety Show, which opens with a proposal for a dance choreography to be performed at the Royal Opera House, which burnt down under mysterious circumstances in 1971 on its 100-year anniversary of the opening opera, Verdi's Aida, for which it was made. In her text, Claire looks at two scenes from a breakdown at the end of a film called Gunul and Shabab, or Madness of Youth. The scenes appear in her text in the form of a sequence of photographs of the original film shot on automatic at half-second intervals. She attempts to break down the scenes of this breakdown to substitute the emotional charge and the charismatic appeal of the moving image, its narrative momentum, as well as its melodrama, with a dispassionate photographic study of motion to reduce it down to movement.
She outlines a series of phrases of a choreography. touches her mouth, loose fingers, loose like they are forgotten, turns slightly, three quarters, collapsing chest vault, contracting face, glance at the floor, turn to profile hands hang. Head back, throat open, knees folding, hands on knees, prayer-like, folding knees, waist, neck, kneeling, chest caving continues, head giving way, screaming, moments of acceptance, another pillar collapse, surrender, supplication, feel for support, hands to floor, breathe, carried by the heat, curve upwards, slight blow from the left, head turn right, hands pause caving again from the waist, head drops almost to the floor, settling here, shaking head, disbelief, sensing someone's approach.
What is Claire doing and why? What is this impulse to produce a dispassionate dance? What is driving the decision to try and fail to strip these phrases that describe the movement of the body, to strip them of excessive expression and melodrama? And what does it mean to take such a position in moments of political upheaval and emotional excess? In Claire's work, but also in the work of many others who've come before her, we're thinking of Yvonne Rainer and, in a different way, Valeska Gert, among others. We were interested in how this impulse was historically constituted. What was inscribed in this aesthetic of indifference, or also an act of madness that was, in a way of keeping from going mad?
In the preface of our second publication, No Fantasy Without Protest, which we printed last October, we wrote, and now in retrospect, we're posing these same questions to Claire, to what Claire wrote in 2013. How do we translate events of psychological violence and lexical transgression? Can we reposition unstable desires into language without arresting them? What is it to interpret these conditions as they register on a corporeal level, at the scale of the individual, and also in relation to the fragmentation, reconfiguration, or dissolution of a group? Wavering ideologies and shifting allegiances meant that what was known to those who had been there then was something they were no longer bearing witness to. Our task was not just to translate words and images, but emotional and psychological transformation, changes in interior composition. How do we transcribe the experience of intolerable complexity onto a textual plane? Ultimately, this is what we found ourselves faced with.
We were working at a time where Cairo was a place with coordinates in flux, and we were all subject to the weather of events. Even though our project, Emotional Architecture, was not envisioned as a project for writing about what happened and was rather committed to writing itself, the distinctions between these intentions was impossible to maintain. Language was a frontier and it was closing in. Even if we did not know how to say what we wanted to say, nor to what end, the compulsion to sustain a community of thought through the process of writing together was what drew us along. 2 years on, these texts have been a long time coming.
Shall I switch here?
Yeah.
Okay. We had wanted to find a location, a language that one might not know they already have, to stand on ground from which the shape of yet unknown desires could manifest. But how does one record the memory of an image of a future that will not be, when transcription and translation turn against themselves? We knew we had to try to keep the past from slipping, to reclaim the moment even as it was being rewritten. If on the outset we were oriented towards the poetics of protest, what we came to learn was what was at stake was much more basic. The site to occupy was that of clarity, an unbearable clarity from which fantasy can begin to exist again.
Thank you.
Yes. And we also just wanted to say that the drawings were by Haik.
Yeah, the drawings in the beginning were by our collaborator, Haik Avasyan. And thank you, Paz and Ansem, for having us here and for everyone else who presented.
So we've had to cut all the questions and answers for today, perhaps because we were so a bit too... too ambitious given the coming months of half closure of the house. I hope you enjoyed it anyway as much as I did, and I wanted to thank my colleagues, Paz Guevara, Elisabeth Krämer, Christopher Hupe, Doris Hegner, and all the others at HKW, and of course Rasha Salti and Christine Kuri, and all the other speakers for their marvelous presentations. Thank you.